Welcome to this week's podcast with a K, available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
Greetings and welcome to Pwack, as I am from here on going to be calling it. I'm thinking about having it like a tattoo on my arm.
I don't. That's advertisement.
Yeah, it won't go out of date, that will it? To Pwack.
Pwack. Not at all.
Not until there's some terrible disaster which takes that name and I've got it forever emblazoned on my arm. That would be a bit embarrassing.
The
To Pwack incident of 2018. Please don't happen. This is the podcast with a K. You're listening to James McLean, and you are listening to my American cohort, Brian Terranova.
It's just a fake American accent. I think we can probably start telling people I'm not really from America.
I did wonder that. I have actually always wondered that. I'm sure people listening to this have wondered whether you are our token American, given in this massive multicultural Western globalization where America is so prominent. We would naturally need to have one token American voice to spread this across a large potential audience sector.
Yeah. I'm actually from Stockton-on-Tees.
Stockton-on-Tees. I was going to say Walthamstow. That's good. Stockton-on-Tees. That's a little more out there. It's a little more obvious. I like that. That's good. That's good. Right. Today we're going to do another commentary. This is from a commentary on a Doctor Who episode that was in the 80s, which is kind of good because in the 80s was known, I don't know about over in the US, Brian, but the 80s in the UK was known for the rhetoric on BBC repeats, where there was just so many repeats on television, you know, and there'd be various critics sneering at the schedules going, oh God, not another repeat of Some Mothers Do Have 'Em, or
oh my God,
Keeping Up Appearances, or Doctor Who. And this in itself, to embrace the 80s, not just solely in the content of the story we're going to listen to, or you're going to hopefully be listening to along with us, Delta and the Bannermen, it too is sort of a repeat, because to our humiliation and shame that we perhaps wouldn't want anyone to know, we have already done this commentary. We did it last week in full, 90 minutes, with chat around the side, so ramping up to about 2 hours, and then found the audio mix was utterly unlistenable to. Mel was too loud, actually, she was, and so was everyone else. You couldn't hear us, which arguably would be a good thing, but then you'd probably be better buying the DVD and actually having the original rather than a terrible pirate, inadvertent pirate copy that we were issuing to your good selves. So this time we're not going to have the any audio in the mix. We did want to have it sort of as an ambient level in the background so you could follow where we were, but we're not going to have it there, so you're going to have to, we'll give you the starter. We will talk and we will try our best to give you pointers of where we are. Hopefully, ideally, you should try listening to this or watching it along with us if you can. If you can't, I'm kind of guessing most of you will remember it and will have seen it. And if you've not seen it and you've avoided it, you'll probably be avoiding this podcast anyway. You think that's probably about right? Do you think that works, Brian? Am I on the level there? Do you think that's... we don't have any choice, to be honest, but...
Yeah, no. I think it was beautiful, and I think it was a very, very good setup. I like how you got there. I like how you explained the situation. We don't have to pretend now that this is the first go around, and I think that's very good.
I think that's terrible, isn't it? And it's going to be interesting for us because we're going to have to do another commentary without boring each other with the same comments. So
right.
We're going to have to find new things to find interesting in this very interesting episode. So yeah, we've chosen Delta and the Bannermen. We will give you a time in when we're about to start, but we'll just set this up. Say this was obviously it was 1987, wasn't it? 1987, first series of Sylvester McCoy. It is a time travel episode. It is a very good episode, and I think by the end of our original commentary on this, we were very, very pro it. Perhaps to a point where we should have been ashamed, and we can now revise that for this episode of this commentary episode. It's Sylvester McCoy, Bonnie Langford. It's a lot of fun. We do really encourage you, if you're not sure whether you want to actually bother getting the DVD out, get it out, because I think if you rewatch it with us, you will find new levels of enjoyment that we have experienced as well. New levels of pleasure. Isn't that what and life's about?
Yeah, and we should mention that we're going to do this one with the show notes on. So get your show notes going with us, because you'll probably want to read them along with us, or at least as we comment along with them.
No, don't do that. I mean, we could have looked like we'd actually done our reading. We'd look like we had done our research. And now they're just going to know we're voicing off the show notes.
Okay, look. They've been listening to the podcast for how long now? Yeah, they know we don't research.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, of course we research. I was just trying to make them feel better.
Absolutely.
You know, absolutely. We're just like you guys.
Well, we're not, because they do research.
We're not, because they do the research, yeah.
Absolutely. Right, okay. So, we're about to press play, so I'm going to do a countdown, and we'll go straight into episode one. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And mine has started. Has yours started?
Oh, yes, it has.
Excellent.
And I see its destination, Disneyland, and the year is 1959.
You're brilliant. You've researched on this.
I have.
This is obviously the original intro to the Sylvester McCoy, well, the only intro to the Sylvester McCoy era. It's one that I've never liked, the swirly 3D TARDIS, which I think, as you said before, the only reason I did quite like it was that the rather flat DePaul toy version actually represented it fairly well, the lack of detail. And
sure, wow, yeah.
Quite similar to a flat 3D model. Malcolm Cole wrote this one. Was it Cole? Is that how you pronounce it? I assume it is. It's quite an alien name. I've never... He says probably being
I hear he was an alien.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. Aliens. So we start off in the quarry, as we do in all eras of Doctor Who. Even the New Who obviously enjoys its little bit of quarry work.
Took them a little while, but we got there, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting opening. I'm just trying to think. Yeah, it's... I mean, we know we said this on the original podcast, but there is a very Toyish Soldiers element to those green shimmer.
Yeah, green army men here is what they're called. Little green army men.
Did you feel that they were soft and pupa-like? I suppose they might have looked a bit that way if they weren't wearing such heavy, thick armor, plastic, and... Because it was just the shimmer and were meant to have a sort of, obviously, pupa-like... element to them. We said this before, but it is actually quite a dark story. I mean, if you've not seen Delta and the Bannermen before, and I hope you've bought the DVD just to do this commentary, it is a very light-hearted story in a lot of ways, and yet in other ways there is a hell of a lot of death in it.
Well, I mean, it's a, you know, Doctor Who has dealt with the idea of genocide before, but this one is really like genocide from the point of view of someone who is about to become that race that is going to die out. And it's an interesting angle. It's an interesting angle, and as I guess we'll see as we go later on, I don't really think they quite explore it as well as they could have from her point of view.
No.
but it does make it a little bit more creepy in that respect.
I think the problem is that they don't really give you a feeling of, and this is a problem actually that was inherent in this season, because it happens in Time and the Rani, that an alien race on a quarry doesn't really give you an idea of their civilization. It gives you no feeling of how they exist. And that I think the Bannermen, sorry the Shimmeron, definitively lack in this story. It's incredible actually how distracting info text is.
Yes, it is.
It's hard to read. Ken Dodd is now making his appearance to Sylvester and Mel, because obviously Sylvester is the Doctor and Mel is not Polly Langford. Ken Dodd is, for those token American listeners, was a big comic personality in the 70s and 80s for the mainly for the BBC. He was a loud, eccentric character, which thankfully we never saw as the Doctor, but you know, was the sort of person that various tabloid newspapers would love to say, will he be the next Doctor, which would be a very grim outlook.
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, if this were, I don't know, any other era of Doctor Who, I guess I could say, he wouldn't, he would have simply been a tall person. It wouldn't have been this outrageous. There wouldn't have been a contest for the Doctor and Mel to win. They would have landed on this this toll plaza. They would have wandered around and then found themselves getting on that bus, which we'll see coming up, if I'm giving spoilers to those of you who haven't seen it before. But we would have just seen them, like the Doctor and companion, we'll say, because obviously Mel and the Doctor, it didn't happen, just getting on that bus and thinking, oh, hey, why the heck not? Or maybe something would have alerted them to get on that, and the TARDIS would have been left behind. It would have been removed from the story. You know, I wonder if that would have worked better. I mean, like, I know we had commented a little bit before on Ken Dodd and his eccentric nature of the performance there, but now I'm more curious about the scene itself. Kind of, was it necessary to make the Doctor and Mel have landed somewhere and be greeted about a contest that they'd won? You know, could it have just been, for instance, one of the characters on the bus? We know something is shady about them, as we learn later on. Maybe they could have noticed that and decided, huh, let's check that out. Kind of thing,
I think,
you know?
if it was done in other eras, they would have, aside from Graham Williams, they'd have landed on the bus. The bus would have been bigger. The TARDIS landed in the cargo bay and of somehow, and they would have been mistaken as part of the trip. So it is an unusual setup like that. Interesting. When we see that police box again, I'm looking at the damage on it. I want to see if it is the same as
box.
The TARDIS.
Yeah, I was trying to do the same.
Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it, when you want to do that?
I'm trying to pay, not even just the damage, I'm trying to pay attention to the paint color, because I know the McCoy box got lighter, but I remember certainly Silver Nemesis, it's lighter. I don't remember if it's lighter here.
I think they were still using, there was two Yardley Joneses at this point. There was not even a sort of hero one. I think there was two models. There was a second one built, and I think the first one sometimes made an appearance. So I don't think it did in this episode, but again, if I'd done my research... That going through the changing arch was very similar to... have you ever heard of the Adventure Game? Did you ever see any of that?
No.
It was a BBC show. It was a very odd show. You can naughtily find it on YouTube, probably, which had various contestants, usually celebrities, who would have to go through a series of games, really obscure games, to get to an end game, which... would get them home, and it was all set on this futuristic, or sorry, this space world, as if they'd been teleported to this world where they had to do these various challenges. And one of them was, a couple of them, they would change from their alien forms into human forms for the sake of the show, and it was a very similar effect to do that. So yeah, Adventure Game, have a look at it on the, you'll find various, I think various Doctor Who people did some of the episodes as well. They had various contestants.
So wait, was that a direct nod, do you think? Did they take that from there?
That was what I was wondering. I mean, it was a little late. It was a few years later than the Adventure Game, this. But the Adventure Game was a staple, and it ran part of cult TV, and it ran for a while. It's worth watching. Like I said, there's various celebrities went on it. It was always celebrities, and they just had to, each room had a various puzzle they had to sort to get to the next room. It was a bit like the Crystal Maze, for those who get that reference. A little more BBC-ish, but yes, definitely worth a look. Interesting. McCoy's movement there again is very interesting. One thing we did say in the commentary that you'll never hear is that McCoy is quite well fitted to this story, and I think it's probably something worth bringing up again, because I think it is very true that whilst this season had a lot of lack of consistency and confidence in itself, this story strangely does have quite a lot of confidence, and it strikes me that McCoy seems more confident in this story than he does in many of the others.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, this is the first time he gets the umbrella, his question mark umbrella. I did wonder whether that's somehow getting a prop that was something that he felt comfortable with, that gave him something to do. I wonder if that helped his performance a little.
I mean, when you think about it, if I remember correctly, the umbrella was his idea. So being his idea and seeing them go ahead and make it on his idea might have even just made him feel more comfortable that, like, these people like me, they want me here, they want me to do this and be happy, and that confidence could have come strictly from there.
I think there's a I think it's on this DVD set, if you have this DVD, and I'm assuming the Region 1 is the same as the Region 2. There's an interview, a Blue Peter interview, I think it is, or a Newsround interview with McCoy, and he seems really nervous being interviewed
really?
At this point, as if he's... not quite sure, almost as if he shouldn't be there, sort of feel to him, which is a shame. But yeah, so if you've got the DVD and it is on there, which it might not be, in which I'll have wasted your time further, but try it. Look anyway. It's an interesting interview.
Yeah, I did notice that shot when the doctor got back in the TARDIS there at the toll plaza. It was the darker box, so even though we don't really get to see the other box again, it looks like it's potentially the same box that they're using in both of those shots. But one thing that struck me was when McCoy stepped into the box was how the phone door kind of jiggled and dropped a little bit when he got in. It's like that box has really seen better days. It's a shame. It's nice. Like, I like the disheveled look. I like the weathered look of the box, but it is a shame that like part of the weathering of part of that's just the everyday wear and tear use of these things. They're going to naturally weather and start to get the hell beat out of them. But it's a shame that like they can't upkeep them a little bit more. Because I remember Colin Baker said during his era getting in that box, he said it smelled awful inside the box.
Yeah, I heard that. And yeah, at the same time, I think it's always interesting when you get actors. And going to Star Trek, I remember this was something they were very keen of with Kirk and Shatner and Nimoy are very keen on, was that when they used their sort of futuristic props, they weren't.
Oh, here it is again.
They weren't considered fragile.
Yeah.
They
used
them as if they were utility. And I like it when actors can avoid the fact they know that this stuff is fragile and just work with them. And things like box must have felt fragile. So.
Yeah. Okay. Pay attention to the weathering here because we got another shot of it. There's right there that little dot on the sign right above the E. There's like a little hole in that sign. They don't have screws on their sign like they do with the Eccleston box. So let's take a look at that. And then there's a little hole right there in the door. Right there, there's a little knot in the wood right where the sign's closing.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll pay attention to those two spots.
Pay attention to those spots for when the
a knot right above there. Okay, yeah, I'll look at that.
There's a lot of scratches on this left post as well. Sorry, I know this is not what most of you want to hear, but...
James and I are prop guys. We like this stuff.
We find that fascinating.
This is a good bit of model work, though, right there. That space one. I really like that.
Tiny lamp on top, but apart from that, I really quite like that shape. So
yeah, I mean the bus with the window. It's a shame. That's definitely a little bit of a model. But when they had the above shot of the TARDIS with the bus in the kind of background, it was really nice.
Yeah, I think also like we've said before, which you didn't hear, it's a nice scene for McCoy that, and again you're feeling his confidence in his role with that umbrella, having a prop that he seems to be really enjoying.
Yeah,
you know, being physical with, as he's obviously a very physical actor. That box like seems like it's seen better days. It's like at the beginning of Spearhead from Space when Pertwee comes out of the police box.
Oh God, yeah.
And he pulls on that door as he falls, and you think that's just an actor being an actor, not caring that door would have probably come off with him if he had just pulled it a little harder. I like it when I see actors just sort of, as you say, making these things feel like utilities rather than precious. But. Yeah, so here we are. This was filmed in Wales as well, before Wales obviously became the place for Doctor Who to be filmed. Which I think, as we've said before, what makes this story very enjoyable to watch, the Shangri-La in particular, is that it's all done on location. That it's not, you're not getting vast amounts of set. I think there might be a couple of sets used, but by and large, it's all set. And feels real, so it sort of adds to that feeling of it being there, situated in an era. Just by the sea as well, which I never noticed until we watched this recently, that back there is actually the sea, so this is on the very edge. I always imagined it being more inland, probably because so much of the locations are inland.
Yeah, I was just going to say, when we talked about it before, I know we had made mention of the woods and so on, so yeah, I didn't even picture that. I know we talked about a lake, actually,
yeah,
before.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
So it's funny, I didn't notice the sea over there either.
But I mean, these camps, for those who are not in America or anywhere else, because there are other places other than America and Blighty, they still are. These sort of camps still are. You know, these are sort of, as far as I'm aware, you know, after the war, these were very cheap places which were often made from war utility places from the war that people could go on holiday. I'm sure I'll get 1,500 people now telling, if we had 1,500 people, we probably do, who telling me that's all wrong. But as far as I'm aware, you know, they were sort of a reaction to the war and trying to get people able to enjoy themselves when they were obviously struggling with the finances post-war. And they perpetuated and they became part of British culture. And certainly this is indicative in our British culture's mind of the 50s of these sort of holiday camps. There was one outside Blackpool where I used to live, and I used to drive past it. And this was about, I don't know, 10 years ago. and it looked absolutely terrible. It was the same sort of camp as this, but it looked like it looked like a prisoner of war camp. It looked, you know, sorry, I think they finished working there now, but they carried on for decades, and as I say, they're still carrying on, and some of them are still going on. They've updated their look and made themselves look better, and they've tried to rebrand themselves to some success, but they all come from this holiday camp that we see in Delta and the Bannerman, this sort of thing.
You know, you're saying all that, and it's making me sit here and look at this thing, and I mean, now I understand, like, the reasoning of why it looks the way that it does, but in the beginning of this story, we saw that little bit of text that said it was originally supposed to be in Disneyland.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder, like, wow, like, they went from Disneyland to this holiday camp, and I don't even know what the benefits are of this holiday camp. There's a dance at one point, like, but that's it. Like, it's really just a place to go sit down and have a dance, and that was it. Like,
yeah,
there's no rides, no events.
Yeah, well, I mean, they'd have events as far as aware, like, they'd have, you know, a night of singers, or they'd have, you know, karaoke one night, or there'd be a dance. There would be, you know, a playground for kids. There'd be entertainers there. The yellow coats there would be entertaining the people in the camp. But essentially, it was a very cheap holiday for people who didn't have much money post-war. And it became a tradition, you know, an escape into these chalets to a break, basically. But yeah, they were fairly rudimentary. And there's a classic 80s television show, which Gareth Gavanna absolutely adores, one of our podcast regulars, Heidi High, which mocks and explores some of the social attitudes within these camps, especially within them. You know, who wants to, you know, one character wants to become a yellow coat, is desperate to become a yellow coat, and the other wants to get out of being a yellow coat, and then you have the, you know, overly authoritative head of the camp and all those sort of things. They're, you know, fascinating little worlds in themselves. I think it'd been interesting if they'd done Disneyland. I mean, as I recall, I mean, the 50s was when Disneyland made its appearance, wasn't it? Because it sort of coincided with Disney's very smart use of the new form of television to promote itself and promote interest in this upcoming wonder. But I'm not surprised they thought maybe this, to be honest, this is more Doctor Who, isn't it? I mean, Doctor Who's always looks less at the spectacle but more at the small, doesn't it? It's always about, because the budget doesn't often cater for much more than that, so how the everyman works and lives is far more important to Doctor Who in theory than the, you know, than the big leaders. I tend to feel that could be a very gross exaggeration, because my brain's now thinking Marco Polo, and certainly the new series hasn't adopted that feel. But I think what I like about this is that you go back to the 50s Britain, but it's not got any of the key things of the 50s Britain, like, you know, when we had the Idiot's Lantern. You've got a key landmark event that it becomes the, you know, fixture for the episode. But this, there is no landmark event. This is just a day in a holiday camp in Wales being subverted by alien forces in the 50s. And I think that makes it feel more real in a weird way, because you've not got sort of prime ministers or heads of states or famous people appearing in it. There we go. Now we're about to see Ken Dodd's death. Well, his character's death, obviously. Though I imagine many people at the time rather cruelly said that they wish it had been, because he was not very popular in the mainstream. He was a very I think he came from the sort of northern club circuit, in a working man's club circuit. I could be wrong again there. I would need to check my references, but he was that sort of comedian. That sort of class of comedian that we had in the UK at that sort of time, that was sort of slightly light, slightly rude, but not overly rude, not pushing any boundaries particularly, sort of variety performance comedian. You could see him on the Royal Variety Performance performing in front of the Queen, and there'd be no worry that he would say something terrible, while obviously if you had Rick Mayall or Rowan Atkinson, you might be a little more concerned. So he was sort of slightly out of date by the sort of late 80s. He was that traditional BBC entertainer slash comedian was losing its value, and he was sort of a little resigned to the past. So I think this might have been an attempt from him to sort of get some validity back. Again,
gotcha.
these are very nice scenes, aren't they? These scenes that set within the holiday camp. I mean, this is a nice one again, where you get these different people talking in the foreground and the actual actors in the background and vice versa, this feeling that they're part of a larger moment.
I actually kind of had this little feeling that the whole time McCoy's been trying to eat this apple, and it makes me sit, and I like it. It's like a funny little scene. Like, he's trying to eat it. She keeps stopping him. He keeps getting interrupted. But it kind of gave me a little bit of a hint, like, okay, Sylvester, we've only got one apple here, so if you could not eat it in the scene, you know, can we come up with some way for you to not eat that, please? You know, just like, that would be the BBC's budget at the time, you know, like, only one apple? And we had to take it from the crafts table, you know, we got to put that back, someone needs to eat that later, you know, it'd be terrible. But it was funny, it made for a little cute little moment between the two of them, and it was well played between the two of them,
too. It's the sort of thing he does well, isn't it? He's,
yeah.
But these, again, the dance, and this is a scene that I particularly like, because you get the feeling of something, you know, something very tangible, something very irrelevant to the plot, that is just a sort of showing the moment, showing, setting the scene, setting the environment. And it's, as we've said before, it's, you sort of lose that in the new Doctor Who, because you just don't have the time for it. And even if you do have a two-episoder, you just pack more stuff in, so you still don't have the time for it. But this is a really nice little moment. I really like it. It's odd to see him without his jacket as well.
Yeah, I was actually just sitting there thinking it would actually... I know we're rough on the question marks and so on, but for some reason with Sylvester, I don't know why... half the time when I look at him, I don't see the question marks.
I see
what looks like a period jumper, as you would say. Because at that time, what I can think of, what I can picture, is All Creatures Great and Small. And they were always all wearing either jumpers with sleeves or the jumper sweater vest kind of things that looked like this style, just where the question marks were, there would be some other design. Now, I always thought it would be great to see his outfit with a proper one that did not have question marks on it. But they're it's funny when they're on the lapels or rather the shirt collars. They're very noticeable because shirt collars don't normally have something there. But as a jumper like this, it doesn't stand out quite as much as you'd think it would, having a repeated pattern of the question marks.
Great scene. I mean, this is one we mentioned in the previous podcast you never heard. Is this lovely one, these two ladies, this lady and this gentleman here, sitting too hot outside the dance hall. Some very nice little touches there that you just don't normally get in, or you wouldn't expect in Doctor Who in particular. It'd be easily missed.
Yeah. It's usually just show the party and stay with the party. Yeah.
I mean, one thing I've always quite liked about, one thing I did like about Stephen Moffat's little meta comments, and he always, I know I complain that he does too many, but one I did kind of like is where he sort of tries to justify this idea that there is a slight pretension to the Doctor, that he is someone who is slightly aware that he is, that he models himself on being a little bit mysterious or a little bit quirky. You know, there's that comment in Time Crash about the glasses, you know, I don't need to wear glasses. And there's those sort of feelings, and even in Day of the Doctor, there's some of those sort of comments about, you know, his different selves and their pretensions. And it sort of makes things like this a little less of an issue for those, I would hope so, for those fans who do really hate the question mark pullover, because it is just more of that. I mean, there's no doubt the Doctor enjoys a little bit of his mystery. There's no doubt that he deliberately doesn't tell people who he is, for whatever reason. And to, in a sense, he does exist in that little niche of self-contrived mystery. He deliberately avoids telling people stuff, which I doubt would actually cause much problem if they know. And there's that lovely bit in Silver Nemesis, isn't it, at the end, where she asks, who are you? And he just sort of puts his finger, whispers into his mouth.
It's weird too, because that mystery to me, like, I never really needed it. It was interesting when they would throw it in, just kind of stuff like that. But to me, the big mystery, or the reason that he never told anybody who he was or what he did, was going all the way back to the first Doctor, when he didn't want anybody to know because he was on the run from the Time Lords and he didn't want them to find him or Susan, you know. And it even extended into the second Doctor's era when he tried to be quiet about it, you know. After that, it didn't really seem like it mattered that you would tell anybody. As a matter of fact, I almost, in many ways, wish that he would have told more people, because then it would have just been like, hey, the secret's out, the Time Lords don't care about me anymore, I can go do what I want, you know.
Well, there's an interesting argument, I don't hear it enough, but I've always sort of considered it, that predates the Superman argument, I think, where that the question mark actually is a sort of, not a question mark, that it is a sort of Gallifreyan symbol that he plays with, which actually refers to his real name, in the same way that the Superman S is considered by some writers to not actually be an S. It's
Yes.
And that is another argument for it, and it's an interesting angle. Like I say, it has been riffed in other super sorry hero genres, but yeah, you could look at it that way. Well, episode one has just finished with the cliffhanger of the Doctor under threat while he's trying to console Rey, who is having a rather bad time with her terrible boyfriend, or no, her terrible friend. It's not boyfriend.
Her terrible crush.
A terrible crush. I mean, they're sort of awkward. Do you think it's a very realistic thing there, the crush there? I mean, that you get. I mean, she says they've known each other since kids. I mean, he seems to be aware. It's not like he's blind to it. He seems to be aware but not interested. Is that how you take it?
The way it looks to me is they've known each other since they were kids, but I get the feeling that he's older and she was that younger girl that was always running around that he always just pictured as that younger kind of like
Right.
annoying kid, you know? Like he likes her, they're friends, but like that crush never occurred to him because she was just that younger sister type person kind of thing. It's just how it played to me, which is kind of sad, you know, when you think about it. But what's even more sad is kind of how he just completely dismisses it later on. And just doesn't give a crap.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting little quote from the Radio Times there, where it's sort of for this episode too, in promoting it as being an episode that sort of focuses on Mel's new mysterious friend and her strange life cycle, and
Hey, go on.
the Doctor being a bounty being attacked by a bounty hunter with blue suede shoes, which seems to mirror the sort of slight absurdity and comedy of the era, of this the, of the, what this era is trying to do at the moment.
I just want to say that Monday, November 9th, 1987, this episode was seen by 5.1 million viewers. The only reason I want to bring that up is because my birthday is November 9th. I didn't know this aired on that day.
There you go. There you
But
go.
yes, I'm with you on the other point, sorry.
That's good. It's an interesting thing to know. And 5.1 million at the time wasn't brilliant, but it
Well, no,
certainly.
that was the issue with this era, that this is the beginning of them starting to think to cancel the show, right?
Yeah, very much so. I mean,
Which is a shame.
I think you get to something like 4.3 at some point in one of the later seasons, which is a shame because, as I say, I think the quality goes up from here.
Oh
But
yeah. I've always said that. I've always said with his second season, which is when they announced that the show was being canceled and then they were giving the show one more season. His final season was phenomenal. And if they had just looked at that and said, hey, you know what? Things are starting to turn around. Maybe we shouldn't cancel this. It would have been great, but they just decided to stick to their guns there. Speaking of guns, this thing, look at this thing.
it's terrible, isn't it?
It looks like they just opened a toy
It
box,
does.
didn't even modify it, and put it on the screen. You know, especially with that orange tip, you know, which is how you signify that a gun is a toy nowadays, you know. They
Well,
didn't really
these
do
days
anything to
you
make this
signify it
look.
by turning it by painting it entirely orange, so
Well, yeah, true.
because, you know, as we've said before, I think, you know, because bank robbers would never consider actually just painting it black again. Yeah, the blue suede shoes. Yeah.
Blue
Little
suede
bit of
shoes and his
detail.
communicator, I guess.
Yeah. Bit of a bit of a trope there, isn't it? Just to leave the shoes.
Yeah.
What do you think of that thing? It's not too bad, is it?
That one is not bad. Once it starts to grow up a little bit, things
Yeah.
go downhill for the Bannerman baby. No, the Shimmerin baby. But no, that's not bad. I'm okay with that
I
one.
suppose there's an interesting thing about its life cycle that it starts off looking like the rest of the Shimmerin, but when it's one like her, a queen, it then changes into a queen,
Yeah,
which
okay.
is.
Here's another question on that though. She was being protected by all those little Green Army men.
Yeah.
She, the woman, looked more human.
Yeah.
Later on, and you know, okay, we've already done this commentary, so if this is your first time seeing it, I'm sorry you're watching it with us because I'm going to spoil something for you here. But when Billy takes the serum to start turning himself into one, are we to assume that he's going to turn into a Green Army guy too, or is he turning himself into a royalty, which, you
Well,
know, somehow looks more human?
I think it's a royal solution she's giving him, isn't it? It's a royal jelly of some sort. So I think it bestows him with the aesthetic charms of being human. But I think it would be funny if, you know, the Doctor went back and he was just a horrible green man, and she found him distinctly unattractive.
Oh God, yeah.
But
Oh, sorry, I liked your pompadour, but now it's gone. Guess I'm gonna have to get rid of you.
Maybe they'd all been her suitors at one point or another, when they'd all looked human, but then eventually, a few years later, they turn into the Green Man Syndrome. This character's a great character. I've really enjoyed him in this. He's very mysterious, ambiguous. Never quite sure why he's there.
Yeah.
But it just works. And I just think as we obviously have said before, but you've not heard us, one of the things I love about Delta and Bannerman is it's got such a wide cast of vaguely irrelevant side characters that just about fit into the storyline, but not enough to feel that they're sort of shoved in there as jigsaw pieces. I like that.
And like the two American guys there, you know, obviously they're there to get their satellite back, but they hardly even relate to the story for most of the time.
Absolutely.
You know, they're, and as a matter of fact, they're very inept at finding their satellite, you know.
The satellite has got no relevance to it at all. I mean, I think it says that they were late additions for comedy purposes to sort of lighten it, as if it needed to be lighter, but they felt it needed some flair. But yeah, the satellite has no relevance to the story apart from the fact that it hits the bus. But you could have had the bus crash for a number of reasons, couldn't you? I mean, you could have even had it sabotaged by the spy on board, the bounty hunter on board. You know, you didn't have to have that.
That probably would have been the best way to address it, really.
I just love these outside shots. Because I think the beauty and the smartness of using the holiday camp is, as I say, these holiday camps didn't change into the 21st century. They looked the same, horrifically the same. There was very little updation because, you know, there was not much you could really do with these sort of chalets. So when filming this in the late 80s, you've got a place which just naturally has a feel of its origin in the 50s. And that's brilliant. And yeah, I'm pretty sure these were war buildings, weren't they? I have a horrible feeling these were sort of like... I really need to look this up, but I'm sure these were buildings that were used during the war for troops and the like, which is why they're so utilitarian and functional. So they were made and then reused. They're found appropriated for a new use in the 50s.
Here's a little fact I didn't know. I'm sorry, because I'm reading the show notes here as we're going, but Sophie Aldred had apparently auditioned for the part of Ray.
Oh yeah, I think I remember hearing that.
I actually didn't even know that before, but apparently, obviously we see her appear in the next episode as Ace, which is strange because one of the things we did talk about before was how Ray was originally intended to be the companion to replace Mel. She was going to leave with the doctor here at the end of the story, but that didn't happen. So wait a minute, hold on. Now I'm a little confused about my Who history here. Give me a moment. What is the next story? Is it actually Dragonfire after this?
Yes, it is, yeah. So she takes on...
So then what the heck made them decide not to go with Rey? It totally is Dragonfire. Because that's weird. I mean, they knew that Bonnie was leaving.
I do recall it might be on this commentary, so just not to make it out that I'm offering some sort of secret knowledge. I have a feeling that Mel was thinking of leaving earlier and then she decided to stay on for one more, or it was something like that. So they'd written this character in and then wrote her out to keep Mel on for one more.
Well, that makes the similarities between Ray and Ace even more understandable now. They had this character of Ray that they wanted to be kind of, you know, into manly things, I guess, or what were commonly considered manly things, mechanics and so on, coming on as a new companion to make her very different from Mel. But then when she doesn't stay, they get Ace and they change her over into the same thing, demolitions, you know, and battle ready kind of thing, you know, more, again, something that was more commonly thought to be a manly thing. So that just makes it seem like they definitely had a very specific type of character they wanted to cast as the companion, and then when things didn't work out here, they still kept the concept. I wonder why, though, if they had Rey, like, I mean, like you said, it's in the commentary, but I really wonder why now they chose not to roll with this character. And obviously I wonder if they just really liked the actress but thought, well, hell, you know, Bonnie's staying, we can't use this actress because we've just used her. Like, I wonder if that was the thing. And this is going to sound terrible, and I don't mean this way to Sophie, but I wonder if Sophie was like the second choice in that respect.
Well, I do recall them saying in Dragonfire that it was a late addition, that she would stay on, that she was going to stay. She was meant to go with Glitz. Glitz was going to take her back to Earth.
Oh, so they just swapped Mel and Ace's role at the end.
Yeah, and then they did a very quick so that final scene, which was written on the fly by Cartmell. I think we need to get Cartmell back and have a chat to him about this sort of thing, because I think it'd be fascinating.
Go on.
Yeah, no, Karen, stay on the subject.
I was just going to say that's strange, because Ray was meant to stay and then didn't, and then it makes it sound like Ace was meant to be the one-off type episode character and wasn't.
Well, it could depend on the recording blocks. Not entirely sure how it was recorded. This is why you should do your research before you do these things, but maybe it makes you as listeners of this feel far more superior in your nerdy knowledge to us, and gives you a warm satisfaction that you're listening to idiots rather than people who think they're better than you. And that might be good. So you might come out of this feeling stronger and more powerful as you head off to your next convention. On Barry Island, right. Yeah, it's just interesting, because I've just been reading up a little on the holiday camps. And the holiday camps, I am utterly wrong. I've reversed it the wrong way around. Holiday camps started at the beginning of the 20th century. The first on the Isle of Man, and they were sort of very cheap chains, but then they were adopted through the wars to be used by soldiers. So during World War One, the Cunningham Holiday Camp found use as an internment camp. With the arrival of the Second World War, the British government realized they could save money by requisitioning the many holiday camps around the company, rather than built camps for training, stationing troops, internment, and housing refugees and workers. So during the war, they became used by troops, and then after the war, when I think there was less money, they franchises became bigger, because they became places that people could afford to stay in. But there's a very interesting long history to the holiday camp, which I would recommend people look up rather than like me, who's just stared at Wikipedia. But yeah, they do, according to this, to do things, you know, price would include things like ballroom dancing, a swimming pool, outside swimming pool I think was common, a fun fair, table tennis, snooker, there might be a cinema there, bingo. So it's sort of very class situated, I suppose you could say. Sort of fun.
I'm sorry, out of all the possible show notes we could be reading, it just said at the end of that scene that the boss character sinks into his chair and eats a small bar of chocolate, which he pulled from his desk. I'm like, really? That's a show note? Maybe I missed something about why that's relevant or important for the time, but that just seems really funny to me.
These are beautiful locations as well. I mean, we've said this before, Island, one that you never heard. But these, we love these locations. And I think, again, this is what makes Delta a really carefree aesthetic watch, isn't it? It's one of the few Doctor Who's which has this sort of beauty to it. Oddly enough, thinking about it, I can't think of many Doctor Who's where you get so much outside locations which are quite picturesque and places you would like to visit, if you see what I mean. Not many spring to mind. Black Orchid is one, maybe. But there aren't many. I mean, the Third Doctor used quite an extensive use of outside locations, also being contemporary based, which is fun.
I am always fond of the Android Invasion.
Yes.
I like that little village in there. I love that's one of the things my friends and I, growing up watching this show, always really enjoyed. Like, the studio sets were always great. Like, I always cite Planet of Evil as like a great studio set for an alien planet location. I mean, I just love the way that forest was represented. I love that. But when they can use real locations in England, it just works better. I mean, the countryside, little villages, even when they eventually get to shoot in London, it's just, it brings the show to a different level, rather than always filming on like four-walled sets, you know, or three-walled sets, you know. And not that they're bad. I mean, generally their sets are good, but somehow it just seems to up the production value to me.
Oh, naturally. Well, I mean, the whole reason of doing them indoors is to lower production values. It's always cheaper to do on site than it is to go outdoors, and then obviously you've got the factor of lighting and all those sort of things to contend with. But this really does benefit. I'd imagine this would have been quite a dire story if it had been relegated to being majority studio based. Part of what makes it breathe is its containment within its outside location, and it feels very genuine. The smart uses of parks and woods and stuff obviously means that you don't time it. It doesn't feel like it's 1980s, and you can say you've got this timeless holiday camp as well. So you really do feel that 50s feel. It has that feeling that they're there. While something like Remembrance of the Daleks, which I love, and we shall do a commentary on that for certain sometime in the future, you do sometimes see in the background or feel the attempts to box it into the 60s in a 1980s world in the outside locations. You know, there's a couple of when they're driving, you can see some vans or stuff in the background. You think, that doesn't look very 1960s to me.
You also have too the shop with the butler from The Fresh Prince, whom I've forgotten the actor's name. The cafe rather.
Yeah.
You get the disconnect there, where it's a set versus the actual locations, where I don't really feel here, like even when they're in their spaceships, you know, like to me that's a spaceship. It doesn't feel like it's a set that breaks the location kind of shooting. Whereas here every building that they're in really feels like a proper building. Like I think they actually did shoot in all locations in this thing. I can't picture many sets in this episode so far. I can't think of any.
This is the weakest thing, isn't it? I think we both agree, is the relationship between Ray and Delta just doesn't either have time or...
Billy and Delta,
yes, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be an interesting future.
Well, the one thing that we noted before was just kind of how Delta as a character wasn't really used properly. Like, they didn't really try to give her great character. The one thing I noted in the beginning of this podcast was that, you know, we're supposed to be seeing that her race is on the verge of genocide, you know, and we should be having a bit more of that sense of urgency. I mean, here, I guess it's okay that she would find somebody that she feels connected with, you know, but it's at the same time, her main concern should be trying to protect her child, you know. But they just didn't even give her a character really to go with it. There's more character in Ray, who they kind of screw over by the end of the story, versus this one, absolutely, who we should be trying to feel something for.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. And as an audience, that is a problem, because the audience will be thinking, I'd like him to go with Ray, because Ray is likable. Well, Delta, while we might feel for her plight, the story doesn't even really bring that out much, and you could argue that we feel frustrated that she seems to be getting sucked into a relationship when her whole race's existence is at stake. So... yes, it is a very. What do you think of the spaceship? The spaceship's just landed on screen. Do you like? I don't think it's that bad. I mean, it's an odd design, but when they do the close-up shots, to the distance ones, it kind of works.
It really reminds me of Silver Nemesis, where they were utilizing like the blue screen technology, I guess, where they had built a section of the ship for the close-ups, and then the larger shots were models. Now, obviously, the landing looked like a model, and there was no gravity felt to it when it actually landed there in that kind of like swampy area anyway. But no, I thought it was an interesting design. It's one of the things I've always really liked about Doctor Who, and it could, maybe it was budget restraints, or maybe it was actually just ingenuity and creativity on the part of the designers. Maybe that creativity was even brought about by budget, you know, who knows. But a lot of the weapons, a lot of the helmets, a lot of the spaceships and costumes and so on were always so much more creative on this show to me than Star Trek or Star Wars or something. And that's going to sound terrible and rude, like I'm bashing those other things. But what I mean is that usually other science fiction shows stay within like a what looks cool, what looks normal, what looks practical, what looks human. Whereas Doctor Who kind of like broke things and thought like, well, yeah, this box with a crane arm cabin that can fly in space and take off from a planet, that'll work, you know, like, and they made you believe it just because it was there and it was working. So what choice did you have? This thing is going to work. I've always loved the design of Doctor Who. I mean, there are some things that failed it, I guess, but most part it was always so cool, you know. And one thing I'll mention again, since these guys are here on screen and they won't hear it since no one can hear the first one, but these helmets that the Bannermen are using are reused from Earthshock. And I love that. It's funny. Usually when I see a reused prop in a TV show, it bugs me that it's like, oh, couldn't they have done something to hide that? But for some reason, it's such a great design. I'm glad to see it again, you know?
Well, I always like to think that some stuff becomes utilitarian through time and may become popular. Popular designs that are resurface over and over again.
You know, actually, that takes me to Star Wars with the Blast Tech DL-44 blaster that Han Solo uses, you know? It's not just... local, or it's not just Han Solo's blaster, you know, like anybody can go out to this company Blastech and buy this stuff. So who knows if the helmets that they were wearing in Earthshock were actually just human technology, you know?
Well, Star Wars has that interesting thing that when they did their Knights of the Old Republic, there's this almost suggestion that that technology has reached a limit where it doesn't really change that much, so it keeps sort of certain aesthetics and functions remain static. Maybe the future has that here, and certain things just stay because they optimize and do what they're meant to do and don't really need to change much.
You know, that scene right there with the boss of the holiday camp saving Mel, giving the option, keep her as a hostage, she's much more used to you alive. If this were the new series, that would be Mel running up to save the boss of the holiday camp.
Very interesting, yeah.
And I actually do actually kind of think that that in many ways works better. And it's a shame. I don't think it should always be the companion, because here it was kind of neat that you can see that there's just a good person on Earth that, you know, doesn't need the doctor to show them how it is to be a good person kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it does work nicely here, but I can see why it works better being the companion taking that role than being a character in the story.
It becomes a danger because you end up having anything that is expositionally relevant becomes the locus of the Doctor. Anything that becomes emotionally relevant becomes the locus of the companion. And so everyone else around them just dries up. And I think you're right, is a real issue for Doctor Who, where it sort of takes anything that could be available and gives it to the companion on the basis that the companion has to, as we've said before, be on par with the Doctor. And I still don't think that needs to be the case. And if they're worried about that being a gender issue and fearing that the companions look like the woman is always lesser than the man, then maybe they need to swap the companions over to men occasionally, and then that wouldn't be an issue. But I agree. I think that's a fascinating point of view. And I think what's really nice about this is, one of the reasons, obviously, he has this, is that this is set in 59. So you're talking about, 14 years since the end of the Second World War. And you're meant to have this feeling that, you know, you still have that residual element to society here. I mean, he mentions in the story that he is, that he fought in the Second World War. So he has that sort of level of honour, that sort of second level to him, which is masked by the fact that he is a manager of this stupid camp, and there we have the stupid ropes. We have the moment, we have the owner of the camp and the manager of the camp and Mel tied up for the Doctor to rescue, and the bonds, as has been noted by Brian before in a previous unheard twack, are very loose. Very loose indeed.
And watch at the end of the scene when McCoy unties them, he literally just goes up to them, I'm taking them with me, Loop, and we're out of here. like they're not restraining them at all, you know, it's a formality.
In this one case, you could argue that they are surrounded by military with guns, so you wouldn't have to worry too much about it. It's almost like it's saying, this is where you stay, if you move out of this we will shoot you, and so hence he can just loop it over their heads and walk over. Yeah, this is very interesting, isn't it? I mean, the Bannermen, is that they have this sort of slight reptilian element to them. The way that they eat and how they sort of have their tongues are red. They're sort of hunters.
I like that. And I like it makes them a little bit more creepy as a villain kind of thing. But I missed show notes here, and I'm wondering, it's got to be real meat that this guy is eating. And it's just, to me, it's like, as an actor, somebody says to you, I'd like you to eat raw meat. You know, is that something people are likely to go ahead and do nowadays? Like, I can't imagine somebody saying, yeah, sure, I'll eat raw meat. No, it would probably be something that was made to look like raw meat. I just can't imagine Doctor Who had a budget to make something look like raw meat.
Well, nowadays, you wouldn't be allowed to feed them it, would you?
No, that's what I'm saying.
I remember when you know, Lance Henriksen did the alien scene where he's cut in half and there's all that sort of sour milk's put all over him, and he was poisoned by it, sort of ingesting it. And you think, yeah, would you be allowed to do that these days? You know, that self and sort of health and safety, hygiene.
Yeah. Here's something I missed the first round for this rope scene. McCoy didn't untie them, but it makes the scene even weirder now. Release those ropes, he says, and two of the guards go over, release the ropes, hand them to McCoy, who throws them aside, grabs his two friends. Then all the guards are like, wait a minute, what are we doing? Let's get our guns trained on him. He's going away with our prisoners. Why untie the ropes in the first place?
I think there is a problem in this episode, in this story, that the Bannermen only have one character essentially, and the rest are just same trooper. And so you do lack a feeling of I don't know, I think you need a little bit of a society in everyone, don't you? A certain hierarchy, a feeling of personality.
It's Darth Vader and the Stormtroopers.
Yeah.
It's tougher when you see people like this because you have faces behind them. You think that there should be personalities with them. But when it's people and Stormtroopers, it's basically they're just meant to be what they are, just soldiers running amok, you know?
So you don't really feel... You feel the threat from Gavrok, but you don't feel the threat from the soldiers. Even though the soldiers are killing everyone.
And you might actually, too, more so nowadays, if you're not even going to get a full army of soldiers, you would get Gavrok, and then you would get a second in command, at least.
In a sense, it might have been better, retrospectively, it would have required a little bit of work, if it was solely Gavrok, and it was one bounty hunter.
Mm.
And if you gave him the right equipment, he could have done that, even if it's just a teleporter or something, or, you know, to get round the story. But I think that would have actually carried more threat than him with his multitude of rubbish men. We're on to episode 3, by the way, now. We're just going through the opening sequence. Once again, we have the McCoy, silver makeup McCoy with his little wink. I do find what is interesting with this story with McCoy is that you still don't really get a feeling of what he's meant to represent in the same way that, you know, Pertwee was sort of James Bond authority. He had the sort of bohemian eccentricity of Tom Baker, you had the sensitivity and sort of brave youthful bravado of the Fifth Doctor, and even the anger and eccentricity of the Sixth. At this point, McCoy doesn't... It's like when he's in the dance and he's there without his jacket, and I was thinking, I'm not sure what he is to these people. Is he just like a weird uncle? How do they perceive him? How would you sum him up? He's a clown, really, at this point. He's not really a...
That's a good point. That is a very good point. Because, you know, I mean, when did they lose that kind of aspect to the Doctor, too? Because, you know, the First Doctor was supposed to be your grandfather. The Second Doctor was more so that uncle-type character.
Yeah.
But what was the Third Doctor today? Was he still the uncle-type character? What was he? The James Bond way is what he's always known as. But is that really how you can describe him in relation to the audience or the companions? Like, who was he supposed to be? Because... You get the Tom Baker, and I know they always throw out the bohemian thing, but, you know, he was just a crazy alien. You know, like, you don't, it's not that you can sit there and go, well, he was bohemian, that's what he was. Like, how do you relate to that? You know, like, Tom you relate to just because he's so crazy. It's so strange. You're not sure how you relate to him, but you just like him. So it is weird. Like, do they need to have a typical type of character to list this person as? Because Sylvester just seems to me, oh man, how does he seem to me? It's funny because one of the reasons why James and I actually chose this story is because we both have an affinity for the Seventh Doctor. And thinking about it now, talking with you about it, I can't pinpoint what it is about him outside. I just like how he plays a Doctor, but I don't have that kind of name for his character.
No.
I don't have that way to describe him to people.
Certainly not at this point. I mean, the only thing I would describe him at this point, the nearest reference would be Troughton-esque. There is a lot of, which is a very inbound reference to someone else rather than to a character type, but it does feel like he is a response to Troughton in the way that he is portrayed, in the way that he is he does have that sort of gentle uncleness about him. But I suppose, unlike Troughton, they did pressure him with a lot more visual eccentricities that maybe were just a little over the top, which Troughton initially had with his ridiculous cap, hat, and recorder, which were dropped fairly quickly. But they initially had that same issue with McCoy as they did with McCoy, that they overplayed him. And so I think that's always interesting to remember, that these classic eras of Doctor Who, like Troughton, suffered that same sort of uncertainty as you do get to a certain degree with McCoy initially. But McCoy finds his route, and by this, I think by this next series, he is what he is often cast as an enigma. And, you know, take the aesthetic aside, he sits outside of everyone. He's not really. It is almost like his role in the universe is a job. There's that, as you say, that scene in Remembrance of the Daleks when he's in the cafe. and he's talking to the Fresh Prince guy, and you feel that he is talking to him to a degree, but he's just talking to himself. It's bouncing off his own internal issues, which are far distant from all these people.
You know, that's actually gone.
He's at this point, he's very much within the crowd.
Yes. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because I realized all of a sudden the way I usually describe McCoy to people, like you said, is later on, his later on persona, which is he's the planner, he's the plotter, he's the guy that's cleaning up his own messes, which is great. It's a great characterization that you finally have a doctor that's kind of like, you know, I do have some responsibilities. You know, I can't just do something and leave. I have to go back and clean up those things that I didn't clean up before, which brings me to something when I was able to interview Sylvester McCoy about 3 years ago, going on 4, I guess. No, probably 3. And I had asked him how he felt about his death in the TV movie, just because I was curious. I know so many people say that he shouldn't have been in it, and I know Sylvester's been saying that in many years and so on, recent years, rather. And I wondered how he felt, because I had a very specific way I felt about it. And he told me he just went into his standard answer of, you know, I felt that that I shouldn't have been in it. The TV movie didn't work because I was in it, kind of thing. And it's like, no, this is the answer you've been giving in later years. Like, I want to know how you genuinely feel. Do you think it was a fitting end, or do you think you would have liked a heroic end for your doctor to go out saving the universe and boom, you're out saving the universe rather than just walking out of the box getting shot? And then he turned into more of a realistic kind of answer, a more like, here's a genuine conversation we're having, where he said that he would have preferred a heroic death. And I told him, I said, you know, I always really liked your death in the TV movie. As much as some people complain about it, I liked it because here's this doctor who planned everything down to the last detail, generally even making concessions for when plans may go awry, rather than doing everything on the cuff the way previous doctors have done. And here the one thing that he couldn't foresee was his own death. And Sylvester loved that. And I was really happy to see that he loved that. You know, I thought that was really cool. Real quick, I'll do a little sidestep here. That is the same box. Those little damages that I pointed out on the sign by the door, they're the same thing. But I thought that was really cool. And that is something to me that's how I describe him. So these early years, like you said, it is them taking their time to find his footing. And perhaps there's no way to properly describe him in the early years, because they couldn't even properly describe him until they found what they wanted him to be later on.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. Oh yeah, so we're now on to the box, and the it's funny that they did that. Given, as I say, they do have a back door to it, so they could have just changed the prop look a little by swapping it, turning it the other way around, where the back doors are slightly different to the front doors, to create a little bit of distinction between the police box in the show and the TARDIS that's in the show, because obviously police boxes were around in the '50s. Yeah, there's a lot of this. Delta of the Bannermen was commercially released as part of the 25th anniversary cassette and album. Well, album, as it was, 25th anniversary album. And it was really enjoyable on the album. I had it. I've been meaning to see if it's ever been released. And every time I've checked, I've never seen it as a re-released CD. But it's a great little CD of music. The music may have been a little harsh and a little too electronic and a little synth in this era, but in itself it's actually quite nice little bits of music. I would think I'd have liked something a little more orchestral, maybe, ideally.
Sure.
But in itself it's worth checking out. No, yes, it's a very unusual set of characters. I think the other thing I really like about Delta and the Bannermen, and it's a criticism I've always had with a lot of Doctor Who, is you always end up being backwards and forth between set piece A and set piece B, sort of Power of Crawlism, where you have two camps, where you're just back and forth between those two camps. You don't really have that with Delta and the Bannermen, aside from, obviously, the camp itself. But even the camp itself is not the singular one set. It's many different areas of the camp that they approach. So it never feels static. It never feels restricted. It feels like the area breathes. So they explore many areas of this Welsh vicinity in the '50s, and it's great for that. It's what I wish Doctor Who would do more of, and it never really does.
Yeah, it is amazing when you think about the budget that the new series has, and yet we still get too many episodes where they're just running around the same three sets.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've said this before. especially since Smith returned, but you can still level this at Davis's era, that you've got such a wealth of British locations to utilize, and especially for, you know, it has such a large international audience who are interested in Britain. And, you know, when you hear them heading off to various different places to film outside of the UK, you kind of think, well, you know, surely you should be going around the UK, and that's quintessentially what Doctor Who is about. And it's a British show. You can't hide from that. So why not just embrace your culture? And this episode does that so beautifully.
It really does. I mean, these are the things that... You know, many of the listeners here probably know that I've been over to the UK many times, and I really enjoy it over there. And this is what I love seeing in these particular TV shows, is the places I've either been or places that look like places I've been to, yeah, that you don't get over here. And we remarked on the podcast that went missing that, you know, there's a lot of similarities between where I live and this area of Wales here. A lot of the foliage will look similar. Like, I might walk somewhere and find places that look like this, but the architecture and the lifestyles are completely different, as similar as they can be. And you just don't get that. And somehow it comes across on film how different those things are. So while they may look similar-ish just because the trees or the grass is something that is all around the world, it's still different. The way you guys live is very different. The way you build things or set up your life over there is very different. And I love it. And it always comes across. And that was one of the things that always attracted me to British television when I would watch it on PBS growing up.
Oh, that's a great house in the background there as we're just coming down the road. The beekeeper's house is a beautiful little quirky house, which is very Britain-centric.
I totally agree. This ship, too. I mean, like... For being a set piece that was made for this rather than a standing location, this thing looks great. It looks like it's been through space.
Yeah.
You know, it's been through the atmosphere. It looks real. It doesn't look like a wood piece of set. This actually is a really nice bit of the ship there.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
There's a lot of really good production value spent on this particular episode.
It's good production. There's good...
The story.
Your story's fun, and you've got... Great direction. I think the direction's very strong on this. As I say, those little, especially when the camp moments, when you have all the 50s elements involved. That goat does not look pleased with being manhandled there by Don Henderson. But yeah, no, it's very unusual. And it was what I liked at the end of the 80s. I mean, again, if we're going to promote the McCoy era, and I think to some degree, I never thought I'd say this, you can say this a little bit about the Baker era, where some of it started. There is a lot of attempts to do things differently, and you can feel the breath of fresh writers appearing in the show. Delta and the Bannermen is obvious one. Happiness Patrol, I think, is a fantastic satire. Brutally blunt satire, which has a lot of interesting elements going on in there. Vengeance on Veros in Colin Baker's era, I think, has got some interesting approaches to how it's put together. Okay, it's not sort of new writer stuff per se, but it's just some really fascinating little bits and bobs that are happening here, and challenging the conceptions of Doctor Who and science fiction at the time, trying to find new ways of modernizing it, I guess. And not always successful, but trying.
Yeah. That was another thing that I always liked about this show was, again, I talked about the production values and the costume designs and so on, but it seemed like with the stories, they tried to go in other avenues that other science fiction TV shows didn't go to.
Yeah.
And maybe, like you said, it didn't always work, but I liked it. I mean, it was always great to get this different take. If I wanted to watch something Star Trek, I would watch Star Trek, you know? And I like the fact that this show doesn't try to be Star Trek, which is an issue that we get when we get into Moffat's era, and he wants the show to be a little Star Trek. And it's like, it's not that show, you know? It's just, you should be stretching the limits. Sometimes even stretching the absurdity, but not to the degree that it's absurd. You stretch the absurdity to the point that it still makes sense. You know what I mean? I don't know if I can say that properly, but that's something that Doctor Who always did, where it was like, this stuff is so outlandish and ridiculous, but it still works. Or at least most of the time it works. Like in this particular story, I'm with the story. I like the story.
I think the difference between I've got to be careful here because it's not quite true. I was going to say, I mean, one an article I've been rewriting that deals with the 70s and Doctor Who, and obviously the impact of Star Wars, is, you know, in some respects, you know, when you've got the sort of spectacle and fantasy elements that Star Wars sort of brought to science fiction again, and the costs of doing that, and something that Doctor Who could compete with. In a way, though, it didn't want to, because that sort of Star Wars fantasy was a sort of largely escapism. It becomes a sort of static, a sort of non-cultural, a sort of ahistory almost, though, where it doesn't have a culture attached to it. And you watch Star Wars, it doesn't really, certainly the first three movies, don't really comment on your culture or on contemporary issues. It is fairy tale, essentially. It's a myth. It's building on myths and fairy tales. While Doctor Who and Star Trek, to be fair, I was forgetting Star Trek, deal very much more about sort of an analysis of cultural issues or things which are dealing with cultural politics. Star Trek especially, but Doctor Who does as well. And I think that sort of makes it a very different beast. And I think it was always a shame that by the 80s, Star Wars had given it something which people could compare it to and say, you know, well, science fiction is all, you know, about excitement, explosions, and, you know, even Star Trek has gone to the movies now and become less about politics and more about, you know, spectacle.
Yeah.
But Doctor Who could never do that, and it's very much grounded in culture. I mean, this is about culture. It's an exploration of the 50s, with a genocide subtext, which isn't very strong. It's mainly about the 50s. I love this as well. The way they're sitting in this hall, this empty hall now. We've seen it all busy earlier, and now it's not. And even this room is, you know, it's on location. It's not a set.
Yeah.
And I love that.
And, you know, you could tell that, too, because the camera somehow picks that up, like studio lighting.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I've never actually considered that before, because I always just assumed it was the video type cameras. But I feel that the studio lighting, the way sets are lit in studios, at least in this era, or at least at the BBC during this, the entire classic run, we'll probably say, really shows that you're in a studio set. Whereas when they shoot in a location, it's always different because you can't have that harsh overhead lighting.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one thing with the 80s for me. Like, there was a lot of good work in the 70s. The 60s, it's a different beast to me. The 60s, especially since a lot of it was shot on film, or I know some was on video, but it had like that film look, or maybe it was just the transfers of what exists. But it looked good to me, the 60s. The 70s had a lot of stuff that looked good. But once they hit the 80s, it seemed like everything that was a studio set was just so harshly lit. Certainly in Davison's era, you got very few stories where they actually had good lighting. And I don't want to say all of them in his era were bad, because there were a couple that were really nice. But I mean, most of them were just so lit.
There was a fair bit in the 70s that was sort of split between film studios, wasn't there? So you'd get that shift.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of obvious ones. I think Planet of Evil springs to mind. And you could, even bits of Robots of Death, you can see the shift between film studio and TV. As you say, it's the difference between film and video. And I think you're right. I think this era is studio lighting always had to be so harsh. So when you get out of that, everything becomes so much more consistent. It becomes so less, as you say,
jarring.
Jarring, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Jarring, like the honey jars. Jarring.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's just another, like, really good thing that it has going for it. Even when they're in the spaceship sets, they don't look like they're overlit.
No.
Which is really nice. But, I mean, even then, they do, you know, the spaceship sets, yet again, they obviously look like sets. But not in a bad way, because they're spaceships. They're supposed to look different. You know, you're not going to go in a spaceship and expect it to look like an Earth building, you know, or an outdoor setting. So I don't mind that. And that was kind of one thing with Planet of Evil. It was either spaceships or Earth ship habitats, you know, space bases, if you will. So I didn't mind how studio jarring things looked in that particular story, exactly. Because it wasn't like they were going from like, I'm trying to think of a good example of Earth set story, and I'm thinking of not Frontios, where am I at now? Oh my goodness, I can't think of the name of this story. It's a Peter Davison story.
Earthbound, are we talking here?
Yeah, it's Earthbound. It's the one where they go to that little city, that little town, rather, where they're doing The Awakening. Thank you. Yes, thank you. Jeez, that took forever. But there were some sets in there where clearly they were in sets. And so when they were outside, because they did some outside shooting in that, which looked really nice. But when they went into some of the interior sets, it looked like a studio. Like, for instance, I'm picturing when the face popped out of the wall in that one cathedral-like building, which was actually a pretty nice set. I shouldn't really pick apart that story because maybe it was a little better than I'm remembering. But there was definitely a jarring element to it where you had these beautiful British landscapes as most of the setting. And then you go inside and it's clearly... a studio. Absolutely.
Stones of Blood had a bit of that as well. The image of the Fendal.
Yes.
To. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it can really pull you out. And it's you sort of had to get used to it. But like this, I mean, that's a nice shot as well, where you've got the ship. I think we must say the ending, I think, is quite neat. How to get rid of Gavrok in the end. It's not the Doctor per se. The Doctor sets up the way of attack, but the attack ultimately comes through the newly born offspring of the race that he's trying to kill.
And look at this shot here. Look at how this is lit. Like, light is coming through the rafters in the top. You know, it's making it look like they made an attempt to do like film studio lighting in there. That's why the ship sets work in this episode. There's no harsh overheads. I mean, it is overhead, but it's being split by the rafters above, which is great.
I like this as well. If you notice that there's a shadow dropping over just in front of them in the wider shot, which is to almost suggest like there's the ship in front of them. They've cut the shadow. I just thought that was a nice approach to sort of give a sort of sense of positioning.
I see that serum Billy was taking changed his clothes as well.
I was going to say, yes, he's not got the green clothes, so I think he's lucky. I'm probably going to turn into a woman, actually.
Yeah, right.
Again, we have what we mentioned is this very sad ending for Rey in a weird way, where it shouldn't be a sad ending, but it's just the way it's shot. The way she's ejected from the group early. I think that's the other problem, is that Weismuller is still here, but Rey is ejected from the farewell, even though she has the far bigger role than the two Americans. And she has to awkwardly get on that bike, which she doesn't look very comfortable on for some reason, and drive off towards the camp, oddly enough.
And I do have to make the one comment I made in the original one, because I think it needs to be said, that we know plenty of women today who would be happy to see a story where the girl rides off with a motorcycle of her own rather than the guy that she was pining over through the entire story, you know? So, yeah, it's kind of sad. We also joked, too, that she just drove off and hid behind the bushes because she still works here. Yeah, like, where is she going?
Where is she going to go? It's that old classic Strangers with Candy joke where you see them drive off and then just turn the corner and stop at the next position, which is just in front of the gate, get off, and then walk into the camp. That awkwardness, because I'm sure we've all had a moment where we've had to leave a group of people and just felt that it was just at the wrong time, or just felt, I don't know, as if, you know, you should still be there, but you had to go. It's a very odd... very odd moment. And I always like this in Doctor Who, where you have the things getting back to normal, where the right people appear. It's as if what's happened has been like a fairy tale. Everything's being resolved. Everything's moving on. I think it's a nice
reality
touch.
Has been restored, basically. Yeah.
And we must finally point out as we end here that these two American characters were two characters that you thought were British actors, didn't you, originally?
Oh, we're going there. Okay.
We are going to go there, because I think that's quite an interesting moment. I think it's quite interesting, and it exists solely for the reason you're here as a token American.
Yes.
Clearly not a token American, as you say. Where were you from?
Stockton-on-Tees.
Stockton-on-Tees, yeah. That you thought that the Weismuller and his companion were British actors doing bad American accents.
Yeah.
In fact, they're both American-born.
Yes, and they still sound like they're doing bad American accents.
Which, as we believe, is because they're obviously doing accentuated accents, I think, for the British audiences. And they've been asked to accentuate, so they sound unnatural. But, your initial thoughts were that they were British, which is quite fascinating in its own way.
And yeah, I really thought... No, Very surprising, very surprising. And it wasn't even that they were transplants to England, where they would have picked up, you know, a hint of the local accents out there. They were just American actors with long American histories that, for whatever reason, were a part of this show.